Hi, it's Rob here. Sorry I can't get to the phone, but if you leave your name, number and a message, I'll get back to you soon. Thank you.
Please leave your message after the tone. To re-record your message, key hash at any time.
Hey Rob, it's Dan. Hope you're doing all right, mate. Just haven't heard from you in a while. Just wondering if you guys are all right, you and Claire. Haven't seen you on the Among Us games or the PlayStation for a while, so just checking in, see if you're all right. Is that it for the podcast? Or, I mean, yeah, you're not answering my calls anymore, so I feel like we've finished it. But yeah, I hope you're doing okay, mate. Speak to you in a bit. Bye.
Can't take your call right now.
Just leave your message after the tone.
And when you're done, press hash or just hang up.
Hey, Tara, it's Dan. Hope you're doing okay. Just checking to see if you've heard from Rob recently. I've been leaving him a few voicemails and trying to get hold of him, but I can't seem to speak to him. I don't know if he's all right or if he's unwell or something, or something's happened with, I don't know. Yeah, so yeah, if you fancy, if you give me a call back, yeah, I'd love to see if you've heard from him. But yeah, speak to you in a bit. Bye.
With musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hey Tara, how's it going?
Hey, how are you, Dan?
Yeah, nice to actually haven't ever met you, so it's nice to actually put a face to the voice and the Among Us games.
I've just tried to kill you in the control room a bunch of times.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just, thanks for giving me a bell. I was just seeing if you've heard from Rob recently, just because I haven't heard from him in like months.
Yeah, no, he seems to have dropped off the planet.
Okay, it's not just me then, it's you as well.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Mm. I speak to Claire.
Okay.
Have you tried Claire?
No, I should probably, yeah. No, I need to, yeah, they've both been very elusive and like just not responding on the group chat and stuff, but I don't know. Anyway, I was ringing just because I've believe it or not, I've been missing doing the podcast. So I just wondered if you fancy doing an episode once or twice. Yeah, I mean, yeah, because Rob always wanted you to get you on to do some hosting. So I thought if he's not here, we could just do some without him.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, great.
I'm so up for this. Let's do it.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, maybe we'll have a sit down and chat about kind of what interviews we could do and stuff. But anyone like you want to get on. But I mean, I don't think Rob would mind. He's not responding anyway, so we can just do it. But yeah.
Hang on. Rob's requesting to join the Zoom.
Oh, did you invite him to the Zoom?
Well, yeah, it's the Jazz Podcast. He's like the guy.
He's probably the host of the count, isn't he? Oh, yeah, let him in. Let's see. I haven't seen him.
This is awkward. Hey, Rob.
Hello. Welcome to the Jazz Podcast.
Rob Cope, where have you been?
What have we got here? What have I stumbled into?
Where have you been, Rob? I've been leaving you voicemails.
Dan, it was a hard Christmas, right?
What happened?
A pigeon fell on Christmas Day down the chimney of our house.
Right.
Like, fell,
and
you know.
It landed on your phone, did it? Or
three
what?
Stories. No, I can't explain to you the trauma of having a pigeon the size of a turkey in the house for 12 hours.
What, it got into the house?
Well, it was stuck in the top of in the bottom of the chimney where the lounge is. Hmm. And
then did you have to get a man in?
So I've heard it fall down and assumed that it had fallen but gotten out. And then that night, it was like Christmas, you know, we're watching a film and I lit the fire. Oh, it was horrible. Oh my God, it was horrible.
Rob,
did you hear it?
Yeah, it was like 3 centimeters above where the flames stop. So I heard it like flapping and panicking, at which point I then was trying to put the fire out, but it was really going. So I was like grabbing flaming logs and chucking them out the door. And anyway, it was traumatic to say the least.
I can imagine, but like, I haven't spoken to you in ages. Like, how long did that go on for?
Like 12 hours.
Okay.
We did get
you got
a man
PTSD
in.
PTSD then.
We got a man. Claire got a volunteer to come, and he like just went in the lounge for 2 seconds, put it in a cage, and wandered off with it. But
hang on, it was alive.
Oh yeah, it was fine. It was. I managed to like. We downed.
Oh wow. Okay. I've written it off.
It was the. Bless it. The man that came to save it said its tail feathers were damaged and it had soot in its eyes, but it was like. Yeah, it was fine. So anyway,
good. That was, happy ending.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a while since we've done an episode. I've actually asked Tara to take over from you.
Dan, that's fantastic. Good work.
Yeah. So you're going to be a bit redundant. I mean, you can be editor if you want.
I would love to be. I'd just be an honour to be involved, to be honest.
Well, you're accepting it. You don't want. You're not fighting to kick her off, or.
Oh God, no!
Okay, good.
No, this is just a great, great turn of events for everyone. No, I will humbly accept my role.
Oh no, you.
We could do the three of us.
Oh, I love that.
All right, okay, go on then. But if Rob's still happy to edit, because I can't be bothered to do that bit.
Oh, it's the worst. Well, great. I say the worst. I send
you
it to
you. Don't edit at all.
No, I send it to a sick form.
That's true. We don't do any editing, do we? We're very much
every time somebody goes, let's edit this out, and then it's in the podcast.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that for the listener. There's a lovely flute student who actually checks for swearing, just so we don't offend any younger listeners, but that's about as far as it goes.
That's nice. Fantastic. How old is your student?
She is 17.
Okay.
So she's
it's not like 11. Checking for swearing. Yeah, very appropriate job.
Yep. Before we started, that doesn't work. We can't before we started because I was dead.
We will have to edit this bit out.
Yeah, we will, genuinely.
Okay. Where do you want to go with it now?
Dan, did you watch The Mandalorian?
Yeah, I've watched the first one. I haven't watched the second one.
It's so great.
Are you going anywhere with that, or just?
Well, asking? I can't. I'm stuck now. I can't say anything that will destroy it for you.
Oh right, yeah. No, I need to sign up to the Disney Plus again to get the second one. Tara, you raised your arms in jubilation for a minute there.
I'm so in love with it. My husband bought me a Baby Yoda toy for my birthday.
Very good.
It's fantastic. He sits on my nightstand.
Oh, I want one of those. Does it like
it's
rock?
So
or
cute.
Is it like
flip? Yeah, it rocks and it makes the sounds. You touch its head and it makes the sounds. It's so cute. It's got those little ears. Oh, I love it.
Very good.
What sounds does it make?
I mean, like that. And then there's one of the movements he does is when he's using his mind powers to lift things. Okay. And it makes this kind of magic sound.
Nice. Rob's jealous. He wants one. I can see it.
Oh, I've actually got one as well.
Oh, you've got one already. Yeah. Okay. Right.
My it doesn't make sounds though. But it's like a Teddy. It's, I've actually been using it on my Zoom lessons because, the emotional state of some of my students in this lockdown has deteriorated somewhat. And
do you mean your emotional state or your students?
Well, it's a bit like this podcast in the sense that, like, you know, I think a lot of the kids I teach
it's
are
just
kind
going
of,
on and on and on.
It's going
it
on.
Seems to end.
Never, yeah. And people are kind of done with me at this point. So, like, if I feel like I'm losing them, and I just like slide Baby Yoda into the frame, then like sometimes I will be like, Baby Yoda says you need to tongue that note, and the kids will be like, oh yeah, great.
Is Tara our jazz podcast Baby Yoda? Like, people were getting a bit bored and we've slid her just into the frame.
I could make the noises.
Yes. Well, yeah, exactly. Okay, great. She's our little boost of morale. For
that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Great, okay. Well, who are we interviewing?
Yes, what a question. This interview is with Danny Markovich, who is a Israeli-born saxophone player. But last year he made an album with with Antonio Sanchez on drums and Danny Rabin on guitar and bass. It's the band Marbin, which he and Danny Rabin has done together for years. But Antonio Sanchez is like a guest to make it a trio.
What sort of music is it?
I don't know. It's
like, listen to a track. And
can we just play a track so I don't say anything stupid?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm intrigued now.
All right. This is from their album Russian Dolls, which is very recently released. And can be found on Bandcamp. This is the place to go. By Marbin, M-A-R-B-I-N. This track is When There Becomes Here. Hello, Danny. Welcome to the Jazz Podcast.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Happy to be here.
We're so happy to have you.
Here is at home, but happy to be on the Zoom call.
Yeah, absolutely. Whereabouts are you? Where are you based?
I'm in Milwaukee right now. I moved out of Chicago. I'm originally from Israel and lived in Chicago for many years and then moved to Milwaukee 2 years ago.
Oh, nice. Well, tell our lovely listeners then who you are.
We'll be right back.
Are you a fan of global travel? Are you wanting to see more of the world yourself? Well, then you're my kind of people. My name is DeAndre Koch, and I'm the host of the travel podcast, Revolutionizing Your Journey, where we share stories of everyday people making the most of global travel and also teach you how to do the same yourself. You'll hear stories from people just like you who learned how to travel for nearly free, like Jo, who realized she could take her daughter to Disneyland in Tokyo for cheaper than in the US, or Rob, who flew his entire family of seven to Europe round trip in business class, all for less than the price of economy. Check out the link in the description for the Revolutionizing Your Journey podcast to learn how to elevate your own travels.
Well, I'm Danny Markovich. I'm the saxophone player for the jazz fusion band Marbin. And I'd be happy to talk about that a little bit more if you want to.
That would be fantastic. Yeah, tell us about Marbin.
All right, so Marbin is a band that I founded in 2007 back in Israel with an Israeli guitar player called Danny Rabin, and the two of us moved to Chicago in 2008.
And that's awesome that you moved together.
Well, yeah, I moved from Israel and he moved from Boston. He lived in Boston for 5 years.
Cool. Right.
But we met in Israel. He's also Israeli. And we met in Israel and then I moved to Chicago from Israel. Never mind. Doesn't matter. So...
I love knowing this stuff, how you all like meet and it all works out.
Yeah. But yeah, when we met, I guess it was, we had an immediate click. Like we really liked the same music and he's the first guy that I've ever met that was obsessed with getting better on his instrument as much as I was. So, you know, it's like, now I have a baby and a wife, but I used to be practicing like every day, all day. And he's the only person that I met that was doing that and, you know, was really hard on himself, which I still am.
Yeah.
But unfortunately or unfortunately, you know, good sides and bad sides, but I don't have as much time to practice and beat myself up. But I do think about saxophone all the time still. So we moved to the States, played all over, got to play with a little bit of cool players in Chicago, like Paul Wertico and Steve Rod, before my Pat Metheny group. Pretty much right away, Paul got us to his band that he had in time. But that wasn't like a real big deal for us. We did a lot of stuff in town. And then in 2011, we started touring the States. We did between 200 and 300 days a year since then, just playing every small town. So I know you guys are from Europe, so I don't know if you guys know of the size, how familiar you are with the size of the state or what the states or what it looks like. But I can tell you that the way it looked, like we would, you know, go drive between, back in the day, it was crazy. We would drive between 5 and 10 hours a day.
Yeah.
Play 3-4 hours a night, sometimes even five, like three sets a night. Be done around, let's say 3 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m., then drive another 5 to 10 hours after the gig. Go to a hotel, check in early. Like we would just be in the lobby and be like, asked to check in. And they'll be like, well, check-in is at 3. And it's like, okay, we'll just hang out in the lobby until you guys are ready. And then we'll just let us in.
Yeah.
Because we're sick of a bunch of smelly guys. And then we go to sleep, wake up, play a show and go to sleep again. So we basically won't sleep for 2 days and then sleep for 2 days in one day.
How long did you keep this up for?
For years. So, you know, we played like dive bars, like, you know, the dive bar that you have down the street. And again, everywhere in the state. So all 48 states, and we would drive into Canada and into Mexico even. And just us in the van, I still do all the booking, all the managing. But we started just, you know, with our, if you know our music, the album I sent you is like, it's more jazzy, but usually we play like really hard hitting like fusion or original. Yeah. And we would just go to those dive bars in the middle of nowhere and just blast everybody, or sometimes in a coffee shop. And it used to be like, we would go sometimes to a place, to a coffee shop, and we'd be like, hey, we're Marbin. It's like, who? Marbin, we have a show here. And they're like, oh, okay, we didn't know that. It's like, can we set up and play? And like, sure. And we just set up and blast with all the students that came to work on their laptops. But then, you know, a few of them will be like, man, I love fusion. I love Mavishu Orchestra. I love Weather Report, whatever, buy some CDs. You know, we would stay with people, get some drinks. And we did that for years until we finally got enough traction, enough fans, like just like that, like making a few fans a day.
Yeah.
Until we moved in 2015 to do just ticketed shows and festivals. And now we got to do pre-COVID a lot of way bigger shows. And we're lucky enough to have a lot of audience everywhere we go. And it's a great time.
What year did you found the band?
So 2007, we founded it. But for me, the real time, what we really like, the main time was 2011 when we started touring full time as a quartet.
Yeah. And then it must be really satisfying now that it, like, seeing what you've created through so much hard work paying off and having fans and gigs to play.
Oh, it's amazing because, you know, first of all, it was a great time. So it's like I did, you know, there's not much difference between what I did back then and now. It's like I still get on stage and play my music. So I always, you know, that's what I want the most. So I was still doing it then. Yeah. It's just now I do it for way more money and way more people, right? it's not like I'm rich or playing for stadiums, but yeah, still it's like, it's great. I really appreciate it. And it made me also appreciate every person that comes to our shows because I know it's not easy. It's like,
yeah,
I really saw it happen one by one by one by one, and no support, no financial support. We don't come for money, either of us. So it was a gradual, very gradual and very slow process, but it also was great. Got to meet a lot of people, got to see the States, got to have a lot of crazy stories. If you actually see the titles of our songs, mm-hmm, they're all relating to a crazy story that happened to us on the road. So if you look like in the last album, we have a song called Fisticuffs. We have before that, like Aggressive Hippies, Escape from Hippie Mountain. Everything is some crazy stuff that happened to us. if I'm talking too much, let me know. But if you want, I can tell you maybe.
No, I'd love to. Yeah, do it.
All right, so this is from the latest album we had. It's I'll tell Fisticuffs because I don't like to repeat stories. When I do a lot of podcasts now to promote the new album Russian Dolls.
Yeah,
but I don't repeat stories, so you're not gonna. I don't tell it any other. They didn't tell it yet. So we were playing in a place called Eureka Springs, Arkansas. So I know you guys don't know it, but imagine like a mountain town in Europe, like something really quaint and cool, but yep, somebody poured a bucket of meth on it. And it's the way the city is built, it's like built in rings, basically, that are connected by steep staircases. And we were playing on the top ring in a place that no longer exists called the Squid and Whale. And it was a bar, and, you know, it was when we just started.
Yeah.
And we got to the place, and before us there was a guy playing for like happy hour. He was playing acoustic guitar named Dayton Waters, and he played acoustic like 12 string and was singing covers. And we said, hello, hi, how you doing? Started playing our set, and he immediately loved us. He loved our music. He, like, we blew his mind.
Awesome.
And he came to me and the guitarist, Danny Rabin. And he was like, dude, you guys are so good. Let me buy you a shot. We're like, yeah, let's do shots. And then we were like, okay, what about you? Why aren't you taking a shot? He's like, no, I'm good. It's like, no. We're going to buy you a shot. He's like, no, I'm fine. It's like, no, we're buying you a shot. It's like, fuck it. So we bought him a shot. And I think we knocked him off the wagon. Because when we went up to do the second set, he was just destroying like a bottle of Jack Daniels.
Yeah.
Like, it was like, give me a shot. One more. It was just like, pow, 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 pow. Like into our first song. It was already completely trashed. Right, and then in the next set, he came to us. Well, before the next set, he was starting to go outside. And he's a big guy. And he was just grabbing people forcefully from the street and bringing them into the show. And be like, you gotta see it. You gotta see this. And he just bring them in, and we're terrified, don't know what to do. And we're like, oh, dude, if we have him in every show, we're going to be famous in no time.
Yeah, let's pay this guy.
Yeah. And then after set break, we come out, he's like hugging us, we feel his stubble on our face. We're like, oh, it's kind of creepy. Trying to run away from him. Okay, playing last set, and he's just drinking all the time. So we get out, we pack our van really quickly and we run away and we drive 2 miles to the 2 miles is let's say 3 kilometers to the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 3.2 or something to the hotel. And we had some girls with us and we're just, you know, blasting music in the parking lot and having a good time. When a neighbor, like somebody that lives in the hotel, like full time, comes out with his, you know, without a shirt and started screaming at us, what are you doing here? What the f*** are you doing here? People are trying to sleep. It's like, and we were like, okay, trying to be civil, you know, be like, hey, yeah, everything is cool, let's chill out. When all of a sudden, from the bushes, Dayton starts, like, out of nowhere, we didn't know it was, jumping out of the bushes.
I love
running bushes at this guy and just punching him straight in the face. Now, the guy is on the floor. Dayton is hovering above him, like doing the fisticuffs, like you guys know, British fisticuffs, and saying, you're not good enough. And he says, you don't talk to Marvin like that. And they were like, well, I guess you don't. Anyway, the guy got up and he was very good. He kicked Dayton like Karate Kid straight in the face, and then Dayton passed out.
Oh, poor guy.
And and we called it the night. But we fortunately we named the song after him called Fisticuffs, which we had on our 8th album called Strong Thing.
That's awesome.
No, thank you. Yeah, every song, but if you look at on titles, every song has a story like that attached to it.
Yeah. So can we talk a little bit quickly about how it was like, what was it like growing up in Israel with like learning and the music scene?
You know, I think it was really, I think it's really good in a lot of ways. And I'm not very familiar with anywhere in Europe, honestly. So mm-hmm. maybe it's, I feel like it's kind of a same, but maybe it's not. So you can tell me. But the farther away you are from something, I think the more, you know, the more perfect it looks. You know, right. It's like if you see a woman or something in a movie and you're like, oh my God, she's beautiful, she's amazing, we can have the best time together. But then, you know, but anybody that ever dated or, you know, is married knows that there is no such thing as, you know, you're going to get up on your, you know, wrong side of a bed and you're going to fight. And, you know, it's nobody's perfect, like, you know, including everybody. You know, and that's the same thing with music. It's like I, as a kid, you know, I would listen to Charlie Parker and Coltrane, and I never thought about the reality of it. Like Coltrane, the end of his life, you know, a small club, Village Vanguard, it's very small, and didn't have a lot of audience back then, you know. Or like you have some Cannonball Adderley albums that are great. Like there is a Cannonball Adderley album called Lighthouse, where he plays in the Lighthouse Cafe in San Diego. Yeah, it's great. And, but it sounds like there are three people in the audience. And, you know, I played San Diego. So it's like, I know what it's like, you know, but you don't think about the room itself, but it's a small room. And, you know, the owner and the promoter are stressed out because not enough people came. And the waitress is like, oh my God, I'm not getting any tips today.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, everything is in fantasy world. You're just thinking about those monumental people, like, almost like they're demigods, like they're, You never think about the day-to-day, what it was like and the struggles. So I think that was actually kind of good growing up in Israel. And, you know, it just made me obsessed with the side of the artistic side of it, the music side of it, because there is not enough people there to have to have any business, you know, when it comes to jazz. Like there's no jazz business in Israel, but there's not enough people. It's 8 million people. And 20% of them are super religious and don't really care about jazz, right? So it's like a city in the States.
Yeah.
So it's just not enough people. There are a lot of musicians, but not enough people. So I actually think it was good. So, you know, just to do that. And, you know, it's like somebody that lives in a small town and always dreams what it's like in the big city. It's like, it all seems so exciting. But when you get there, you're like, there's also a bad side to it. Like everything, you know. Was a good side and bad side. So it was interesting.
How?
That's what I could say.
It sounds super interesting. What made you decide to move to the States then? And when did you move?
I moved when I was 22, I think. So in Israel, I'm guessing some people know, but we have a mandatory army service. So I was drafted between 18 and 21 to the infantry, and I didn't get to play at all for those 3 years.
Man, that must have been really hard to not be able to play at all.
Yeah, it sucked.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't fun. I still can't, now in retrospect, I can't believe it. I was like, because when I got out of the army, I couldn't play at all. So I can't believe now that I actually was like, no, I'm gonna be a musician. I'm going to just start practicing every day from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. until I'm good enough to move to the States and start a career, basically. I didn't wait exactly until I was good enough, but until I felt like, you know, it's I can go and keep practicing. It was good. It was interesting. It was an interesting time. It was interesting to build my playing from zero. It's not like I was great in high school, you know. I was just a high school kid. It's like, no high school kid is great. I don't care what prodigy you're going to show me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it just doesn't work like that.
It's not
like, so, you know, I really got to build my playing from nothing. And it was good. It was good. And then, you know, like very cool. I always want to move to the States because you dream about, you see the movies, you have all your heroes are in the States, you know, nobody tells you the reality of it. And I feel like also when you talk to a lot of jazz musicians today, they hide the reality of what jazz really is now.
Right.
Right. So Chicago is where I moved, and it's the third largest city in the States. Right. And they have 3 jazz clubs in the entire city. It's nothing.
Yeah.
And 2 of those 3 jazz clubs are just like tourist spots. So It's not like even like a club and everybody's like killing all the time and you have the best musicians coming every day. It's just like, you know, we have like local jazz musicians that have been in forever, that have their weeklies for years. You know, it's not like a thriving scene. And that's the third biggest city in the States. And even if you look at New York or LA, it's like there are barely any jazz clubs. And a lot of our jazz clubs are just complete tourist spots. It's not like people there like just come because they're for the love of jazz. They go like, oh, I'm in New York, I'm in the States, I'll go, you know, I'll go and listen to jazz at the Blue Note.
Yeah.
So I'm going on tangent. I'm trying to remember what was.
No, it's exactly really interesting to know how it actually feels to move, you know, to Chicago and how it compares, because obviously we're in London and have no idea.
Yeah. So again, from far away, it looks more glamorous. As you know, so I moved without really knowing what the scene is like. And I can tell you this, which is, it's crazy, but when we started doing it, we played, like I messaged people MySpace to do shows in everybody that lived in Illinois. Chicago is in a state called Illinois. And I MySpaced everybody in Illinois, like all the venues on the list from like this website. And I said, hey, can we play? And this one place said, I'm going to pay you $300 if you want to come play for a few hours. I'm in Marion, Illinois. And I was like, okay, and let's do it. And then I looked at the map and it's like 5.5-6 hours away from Chicago, like Southern Illinois, which is larger than Israel, right? Than the entire country.
Right.
And I was like, oh, I didn't realize that's the distance we're talking about. And anyway, got the guys, we went there, and we're going to a tiny town that has a pizza joint and a DVD store, like a DVD rental place.
Yeah.
Right? They still have those 2 things, if you can believe it.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And we went to a dive bar that looks like the same or worse in the dive bar down the block. And we played and sold like 20 CDs or 30 CDs. And we're like, oh my God, that's amazing. Back in the day, it's like, it was unheard of for us to sell that many in one night.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're like, every place in the States must have a place like that. And they, you know, and that's how we started. And that's how I started telling you with the dive bars. But the point was that everybody that was in the music industry, because we got to already know a few people, told us there is no way to do it. Nobody in the States cares for jazz. Nobody likes jazz. You know, the people in the middle of the country, they call it flyover states. I don't know if you heard this expression.
Yeah.
So, you know, and we we discovered that a lot of people go to New York, and then the first thing they try to do is play in Europe, right? And I think what I was saying about how things look glamorous from far away, I think that's one of the main reasons. Because for people in New York, we're like, oh, we're going to do shows in Europe. And some people in Europe, some promoters are like, hey, this guy is from, you know, is from the States. Like, I see some people playing festivals in Europe, I'm not going to name them, that can't sell 20 tickets in Chicago.
Yeah.
But I see them playing like those big festivals in Europe, right? So it's kind of funny to me that a lot of people that you see, like, that come in to play all over the world from New York never played like a city that's like 4 hours away in the same state.
Yeah.
And not to mention never played Kansas or Missouri or like Arkansas or anywhere else that's here. And, you know, so the jazz scene, as far as I'm concerned, in the States is pretty dead. It's like, it's really small, and really small. And it's like, it's really like clicky.
Yeah.
But you know, the people are still here and we're having a great time. We were, again, lucky enough to find our audience. And to me, you know, it worked out the best way it could work.
Yeah. So let's talk about your new album, shall we? Russian Dolls.
It's really, I'm going to put it under Marvin, but it's really like my solo.
Right. Okay.
My solo album, which I did with Antonio Sanchez on drums. And like I love this, when COVID hit, we organized the house and my wife found all this old notebooks of mine. Mm-hmm. And I saw the songs and I thought some of them were pretty nice. I played it for my guitarist in Marvin, Danny Rabin, and asked him if he think we can do an album. And he said he thinks it's good, but only if we can get a good jazz drummer. And we were lucky enough to get Antonio to play on it.
This so seems like good news to me. If you're like, can we get someone good? And then it's Antonio Sanchez.
Yeah, it was my first choice. So it was great.
Well, that's amazing.
I love his playing.
Is it easy to get someone like that involved, or is he just got well up for it?
Yeah, with him it was pretty easy, but it's not easy at all. it's amazing how uneasy it is. It's like, even if you're willing to pay too much money, it's like a lot of people just for some reason pretend they're too busy. I guess it's like my experience with, I don't think it's their fault even. I would say this, like if you message Marvin, I get the email, right? Me and the guitarist.
Yeah.
So it's very easy to deal with us, but I dealt with some people that I know want to do stuff, but once the managers get involved, it's just become like a milking competition. Like I was talking again, I'm not going to mention the name, but when COVID just hit, I reached a few people just to do maybe something together. And this non-guitarist I was talking to, because we have friends in common. So I was talking to him in text. But when his manager got involved, and when his manager got involved, he was just trying to extort money out of me. That's what it felt like.
Right.
And I was like, yeah, I'm not into that. I thought it's going to be fun to do something together. But if that's the way we're looking at it, then no, thank you.
Yeah.
And it got really uncomfortable. So, you know, I don't blame people that it happens. You know, a lot of musicians just don't deal with their own stuff. So... yeah, but with Antonio, it was pretty easy. It was very easy. I just talked to him directly and, you know.
That's amazing.
Think maybe because he knows Marvin, so.
Yeah, I find that a lot with this show. It's like, I can never predict who it's going to be. Some musicians, I'll do an email and they'll get back to me straight away themselves. And it's really easy. But like you say, once the management's involved, it's usually game over for me. They'll usually like, I don't know, yeah, it just never works.
Yeah, because the problem is with management, they just think about this same second and what they can, the most they can get at every second, and they don't care like what happens next week. So I saw it, I saw it with booking, for example, right? So because I do my own booking, but I had a lot of people that approached me and wanted to take over managing booking for Marvin. And I had a somebody was like, okay, you can book us one too. Let's see what it's like. And they sent me a schedule and all the Mondays were blocked. And I was like, why are the Mondays blocked? Because like, oh, you can't play Mondays. And I was like, we've been playing Mondays for years. Of course you can play Mondays. Or like, you can't play this town. This is too small of a show. And it's like, to me, I'd rather make $500 than make $0. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, why would I not? And I'm on the road. I'm away from my family. I want to work. I want to play music. I love playing music. But for them, it's like, oh, I'm only getting 20%. Yeah, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
I don't want to do the work for like whatever it is. And it, with press, it's also a lot of times like that. Like, oh, it's so much work to promote and so much work to do things. And I have to deal with everybody. And it's like, I'm not even getting paid for that specific thing. So why would I do that?
Yeah. That's really interesting because I've heard other musicians say that to me, that they've been advised to like play less shows in order to make them like look more exclusive. You know, that's like a bit of a thing that maybe like a management company, like I've never heard a musician want to do that, but I've heard like managers say it.
There is a point to it in the sense that if you live, let's say in London, right, where you're from. And if you play every day in London, it will be hard for you to bring people out. So when we play, we just play in a different city every night.
Yeah.
You know? And I won't come back to a city unless I have a new set of music to play.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, of course, it's also true that if I played in Chicago once every 5 years, instead of 300 tickets, I would sell 800 tickets maybe, right?
Yeah.
But also, I'd rather play five times and sell 300 tickets and play for 1,500 people than, you know, all together than play for, 900 people once.
Yeah.
It's not worth it. And again, I want to be playing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's how I see it. You have to be playing in order to do music. That's what I think. You have to be shows. It's like you don't have a carpenter has to make chairs and tables at the end of the day. You can't just practice making handles for 10 years and you're a carpenter. You have to do the thing that you want to be. Like you are what you do.
Yeah, I love that. I say that to my students all the time about when they're practicing, like you are what you eat. You know, whatever you're going to like listen to and practice, that's going to come out.
Do you have students? You know what I notice sometimes? Sometimes I have students that come to me and want to play jazz. And I was like, what do you listen to? And they don't listen to any jazz.
Yeah. And you're like, this isn't going to work. This is not how the kind of, I had a few old school teachers that would like be like, if you want lessons from me, we're just going to listen to jazz together. I'm not going to actually tell you anything. You know, more like, well, I figured it out on my own. So, you know.
Well, it makes...
Off you go.
Well, it's really is the basics, right?
Yeah.
It's like, it's very strange. It's very strange to... Yeah, it's like, I want to speak... It's like, I want to speak Korean. Okay, listen to these people talk Korean. It's like, no, I'm gonna figure it out on my own. Well, if you're going to make it on your own, the chances you're going to get good at Korean at the end is, the chances are slim.
Yeah.
If you're just making up the words, you need to listen to jazz in order to, you know, in order to play jazz. I'm sorry. That's the one. Yeah.
So when did you record Russian Dolls? Was it before COVID started?
No, after COVID.
Oh, cool.
I just found the songs after COVID. So after COVID, I did that. So I was just done recording in August, I think.
Right. How many days did you record for?
2 days.
Amazing.
Yeah. Just did all the songs. One day I did all the songs and all the solos, all the melodies. And then second day I overdubbed saxophone parts. So it was like just 2 days overall.
Oh, nice. And did you all do it together in the same studio, or was it overdubbed?
No, overdubbed, unfortunately.
I mean, loads, obviously, with the pandemic, like that, it's much safer and easier to do that than to be able to meet up is really difficult.
Yeah, it is. But I hope still, because I love interaction in jazz music, and with Marvin we always called live, but I was trying to be aware of what's going on and make it, you know, play in a way that that at least I would hope doesn't sound like we were playing, you know, each one was playing in his own room unrelated to what's going on with the other person.
Yeah. Did you find it harder having to overdub it than...
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's not as much fun. That's really the main thing. It's like I love playing live, and this is wasn't as much. But it was still, you know, it was a different type of challenge because, you know, you have something to play over. And we did it in kind of back and forth, you know, me and Antonio. So, yeah. And then Danny knows my music so well, it was very easy. He barely had to change anything. But with Antonio, we had to go back and forth a little bit. But I think it turned out well. I think it's if you listen to it, you're not gonna feel like, oh, we're not relating to each other.
Yeah, totally. So, are you able to book any gigs for it? Can you do some launch shows or anything?
Nope, nothing. Nothing. We got over 100 shows canceled, and that's not including all the shows I started to book in September, October, November. It's like nothing. Because, again, I don't know what it's like right now in the UK, but I can tell you that here they would, you know, they would be like, oh, you can open. And then a week later, never mind, you can't open. And then, oh, you can open 50%. No, 25%. You can do drive-in shows. And I was like, oh, unless you're out of state, then you can't. You know, like they would just keep changing.
Yeah,
stuff around. So, in order to stay afloat, because we thought we had a lot of big tours canceled, and when our summer tour got canceled, which was a huge bummer, because we were going to my favorite area of the States, which is Montana, Idaho, Utah is like the mountains, kind of in the west of the country.
Yeah,
and when that got canceled, we were like, okay, we have to do something to make some money, and me and Danny, the guitar player, just went and played gypsy jazz show, like acoustic. He plays acoustic guitar and I played saxophone and he sang a little bit. And we played all standards at backyards of fans. We were like, who wants us to play our backyard? And we just got a bunch of people and we did like 40 shows, I think.
When were you doing these?
Just like in July, August.
Oh man, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was great time. Like we didn't know what it's going to be like. And you know, one thing about it was even more fun than regular shows. Well, first of all, we just rented a car and like a sedan and just
drove. Yeah.
But we didn't need our van and we didn't barely add any gear. But one of the things that was really fun, that every show was so different, because usually we just, you know, festival is a festival and clubs are just you come in early to a sound check, you know, you people pay tickets, you play, you don't talk a little bit to the people and you're out and you go to the hotel. So that's our life now. But with the people, it's like every day was different. Like we did a homestead kind of small wedding ceremony, like in the middle of the mountains in Georgia. Or we did a show on a porch in the bayou in Louisiana that, you know, the guy fed us fish that he got like from the porch, like he was fishing from his porch.
Oh, wow. That's
and
amazing.
And made the fish. And we just got to all, like we played this, like high society show in a different place in Louisiana that had like all the people from the symphony came, and it was just such a bizarre experience. It's kind of like a David Lynch movie. And it's just everything was completely different because people are so different. So it was really a good time. It's not ideal. I would rather be playing my own music, but it was still a lot of fun. And I love playing old style.
That's amazing though. So that might be the most gigs anyone's done this year. Like 40 shows right now is a miracle.
Well, it kept me alive because, again, it's my only income.
Yeah.
You know, and my wife is a writer, so it's not like she's making a lot of money. So
yeah.
we really needed it. So sometimes, all the time, necessity is the mother of all invention, right?
Yep.
So, you know, so we did that and it was really great. And the only thing now that it's too cold to do it, so... We have to wait.
Oh yeah, good point.
Warms up. Yeah.
Yeah. So so can you do anything to launch it without any shows? Can you do anything like online or anything?
Yeah, I don't know. Do you want honestly
to do anything like that?
I'm not big into doing stuff online.
Yeah.
Because it gives, and I also hate videos on YouTube, you know, even the ones that we put out. I'm not talking about people took a video with their cell phone. Because it gives people the illusion that they know what it's like to be in a show.
Yeah. You know?
But it's not. It's not even close to what it's like. And everybody, I get people all the time, every show when we used to play, every show people would tell me, like, it's nothing, it's not even close. And I was like, yeah, of course, it's not the same thing. You know, jazz.
Yeah.
Every night you're improvising. And the exciting part, you know, the exciting part is like I take a lot of chances when I play, especially live. It's like I really let myself go and take a lot of changes. And sometimes I fall on my ass, which is fine.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the exciting part of it. You know, on albums, on some extent, on album, I try to push myself more, but like the videos that we do, you know, it's like, it's not a show. It's just an imprint of the song. It's like, I'm doing something that, you know, that works and, you know, we don't have, it's still, you know, it's, we have budgetary restrictions. It's like, you know, it's like, hey, this is, it's to promote the shows, but the shows are completely different, a completely different experience.
Yeah.
We also tell stories at the shows there, like with the one I told and, you know, and I don't know, so that online, to do a show online really feels to me like you're giving people something, but they don't understand what we're getting. They think we're getting the real thing, right? Because they're like, hey, I'm seeing the person playing live and I'm seeing it, but it's not the same through headphones or speakers.
No.
And like being there in person with all the people around you and feeling the atmosphere and the sound, like being huge from stage and seeing us move, and just, it's completely different.
What will you do with this album then? Will you wait until you can book gigs to kind of give it a proper launch, or just let it be digital, or maybe make some videos?
I think I'm going to just for now, just put it on our Bandcamp. It's going to be available from November 6th.
Fantastic. On the
marvinmusic.bandcamp.com. So Marvin Music is M-A-R-B, like boy, I-N, like Nancy, marvinmusic.bandcamp.com.
Yep.
So I think I'm just going to do it digitally well. And yeah, once everything opens up, figure out a way to give it a proper, you know, a proper launch that I think it deserves. Because I'm happy with the way it came out. It's very different than our other music, you know, and it was very interesting for me. And I'm still processing it in my mind, the music, because it's, you know, the more you play, the harder it is to really understand how you get better as a musician and as a player. Where I am now, it's my ninth album, basically, and it's, and that one is very different because, again, I never played really on swing, and I did some stuff that's a little more traditional on this album. I know it's not exactly traditional because it's still, you know, as my thing on it, but, you know, it's more traditional than what I usually would do. And,
right.
And, you know, so it's, I see my playing in a different light there, and I'm, you know, I sit and think about what worked for me, what doesn't work, what I liked about it, what I didn't like about it, the rhythms I did. It's very, you know, it's very difficult to see. It's much easier to see what you do and to not see what you don't do. Do I make sense? Do you understand what I mean? And the things that you don't do are the things that would take you basically to the next, you know, the next step. Not necessarily better, but just advance you in your journey, in your musical journey.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's a lot of thinking involved. So I'm still processing this album and trying to figure out what worked, what didn't work, what could be better, what am I not doing, what are my blind spots, you know. So it's good. I'm very happy with it. So I would like people to listen to it. I would be very happy if people get to hear it, you know, and I'm not just doing it for myself. You, as I said, you play also a lot of soprano, right?
Yeah, I do love the soprano.
Yeah. So I'm curious, like, I don't want to put you on the spot, but did you have like a first impression or something that you heard it? Because you didn't know me from before, right? You never heard Marvin.
I didn't, no, but I listened to loads once you sent me the links. And I did watch, funnily, you should mention them. I watched loads of your YouTube videos as well, which I did. I did really enjoy it. And it was just, it was more like, this sounds a bit basic, but it was like more fusion-y than I expected. It was more rock than I expected, but it was great. I loved it. I feel like a lot of people, when they say, like, they describe a mix of different music, but it's not really a mix, you know, it's just like, it's just still like, actually, this is quite conventional. I feel like when you say it's a kind of fusion, you really mean it, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think, yeah. Thank you. And yeah, I still like people to listen to the videos. Don't get me wrong. That's really, you know, I'm just saying it's like, it pales compared to the show, I think. But the secret, I think, for me to make good fusion is that we don't write or play music that we don't know. I mean, like, you know, me and Daniel are 35 years old. So we grew up listening to jazz, but we also grew up listening to Rage Against the Machine and, you know, and the Chili Peppers, for example, right? And we also grew up listening to Leonard Cohen and Paul Simon, the Beatles, and whatever it was that we grew up listening to, we let it come out in our music. But we never think like, oh, let's do a reggae song. You know what I mean? Or like we hear somebody playing, like a Bollywood kind of song. And we're like, hey, we should do a song. Let's do our version of that music. Like music, we don't do music that we don't have an intimate understanding of.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So it's because then it just sounds kind of like a parody.
Yes, absolutely. One of my old teachers said to me once to sort of stop worrying about the things I couldn't do and start concentrating on the things that I could, you know, which really helped me when I was trying to make my album to not be like, I don't know, not being too obsessed with it. Sometimes I felt like I had to be great at absolutely every element of making music and playing jazz before you could sort of do anything on your own. You know, you'd have to like master everything that's come before, which of course is more than one lifetime's work to actually.
Yeah, and it's like, because if you end up, you know, if you spend your life listening to jazz, like growing up listening to jazz, and you listen to all your favorite people all the time, right? You don't listen to all the people you don't like. You listen to the people you like. And then it's time for you to make an album. You're like, well, I want to make an album that level. But you're not going to, the first thing you're going to come out of your saxophone is not going to be Charlie Parker level. You know, probably the last thing is not going to be that. But so it's like to think that the first thing is going to be that is insane. But I definitely know that, and I know that the way that people deal with it, there are a lot of ways that people deal with it. Like, a lot of players are lick players. I don't know if that it's like slang changes from country to country, but
yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, it's like they learn licks at home and then they go out and play them, and or they're like, oh, I know some Dexter licks and Parker licks and Colton licks and I don't know, Chris Potter licks or whatever, and then they write them down and they learn them and they play them. And to me, it's like a bad way to deal with it, because what you're really saying is, well, I don't know what good is, and I'm insecure to put myself forward, but I know that these people are good because I like them and other people like them, so here's what they did.
Yeah.
Right? And my style will be like the mix of them, but that's not really how it works. It's the thing that you said about like focusing on what you can do, it's like people don't understand it about learning, but you can see it clearly if you see a baby, right? It's like if you have a baby that's like was just born and you try to teach him how to juggle, you know, or how to recite Shakespeare, it's not going to work no matter how much you're going to try. The way babies learn is they interact with the world and then they, you know, they get what they get from the interaction. Let's say they move their hand, basically involuntary in the beginning.
Yeah.
But let's say they feel it. They're like, oh, that's interesting. Like, and it moves like a mobile.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And then they try to do it again and again and again until they kind of figure it out, and then they do something else. So it's like growing is really like an inside out kind of experience. It's kind of process, and yeah, obviously, you know, you listen, like I said, you have to listen to jazz, but most of it is from the inside. So once you get a basic, like, it's great to listen to players. Like, when I listen to players, I always analyze everything: the rhythm, the articulation, the sound, the harmonic language, everything they use, I analyze. But at the end of the day, the way you improve is, you know, where you are, you have to take a step forward. Like, if you just started playing, learning a Charlie Parker solo, you know, it's not gonna necessarily make you a Charlie Parker.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, you're not ready for that. Like, some people would spend like a year learning a Charlie Parker solo, right? And for me, if I do it now, I know because I did it like a year ago. You know, it took me like a couple of hours. You know, so because now I'm in a place where I can, you know, I don't have to deal with everything that Charlie Parker solo means. You know, I'm familiar with the music. I know how he plays. I have some technical ability. So, you know, so yeah, it's an important thing, I think, what you said, that you have to focus on what you can do. And then obviously try and push it forward, you know, take a step, always be in the balance between what you know and what you don't know.
Yeah. Well, I love that about my first, when I started listening to Marvin after you'd introduced me to it, was just the identity is so strong, you know. You have to, no matter how anyone feels about it, they have to have the utmost respect for the fact that you know that you like it. And also, you know, I don't know, it's never a good thing if you get those albums that's like a bit of this thing and then the next track's a bit of something else. And, you know, when somebody's kind of trying to find their voice and they're trying everything.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I remember being in high school and, you know, listening to people. And the one thing I noticed immediately, it's like how everybody that I love has a unique voice. Right? Yeah. I was like, Colton is so different than Parker, but it was so great. So I was like, if I want to be good, I have to have a unique voice. And then I discovered through playing that I kept asking myself the wrong question, right? And that's another way. When people, like, let's say that's a different route that people take when you talk about unique voice. Like they do stuff that's outside of music realm. And I'm not saying it doesn't have merit to it. And I actually like a lot of people that play avant-garde and play like prepared saxophone and do crazy stuff. I love it because I actually learn a lot from it.
Yeah.
Because right? They think about it different. But it's basically like if you play basketball, right? There are ways like Stephen Curry, like, you know, the way he changed the game, but it was still in the rules of the game. You can also come to a basketball court and, you know, with ten tennis balls. So I'm not saying it's, you know, I'm not saying there is no merit to it to try and do things like that. I'm just saying that it's a different kind of game. So it's like just to do something because nobody did it before is not a successful venture as far as I'm concerned.
That's amazing. I love that. Yeah, just because, you know, no one's done this before doesn't mean it's a good idea.
Well, there might be a reason. So to me, what I feel like I discovered, well, what I discovered for myself is that I always ask myself again, what's good? What's good about my playing? What's, you know, I listen to other people too, but then I was like, what am I not doing? What am I doing? How am I building my solo? Like on different level of resolution, right? Like the entire solo it's building, and then like the note choices, everything. You know, I ask myself, and if you keep asking yourself what's good, you're eventually going to get to your unique sound because every person is different and every person has a different aesthetic.
Yeah.
So if you just keep asking yourself and not, you know, not giving up, not being like, okay, that's who I am and that's it. Because, you know, you change who you are. You evolve as an artist and as a person. So if you keep asking yourself, what's good? Where should I move next? What can I do better? You know, you're going to end up in a place that, you know, some people are going to like, some people not going to like, but it's going to be your own place. It's going to be your own voice.
Yeah.
As I end the process, yeah.
Can I ask you about your website, your glorious website, the best saxophone website ever?
Oh, that's not my website.
Is it not?
No. I'm glad that you said that. No, I just wrote some articles for them.
Oh, it really looks like your website.
No.
Whose website is it then?
It's a guy from Austin.
Right.
Doron Ornstein, I think.
Oh, okay, and he's compiling loads of... Because if you go on it, the first thing it says is about Danny Markovich. And then and then it says about Marvin Music. And then it's got your biography. And then it's got posts by you. So
really?
Yes.
Well, I'm happy that he did that. I know my post really did well, though.
wrote a few articles. Okay, You have got some really interesting stuff on here, making the case for shredding.
Yeah, that's actually, I was writing it as, do you know a saxophone player called Sam Newsom?
Yes, I did. I had some lessons with him when I was younger.
Yeah, Sam is awesome. I really like him. He's one of those people that were like super nice to me and super great and helpful like from day one. And he does such a, you know, he's one of those people that again, he's like, he's doing stuff out, kind of outside of a realm a lot of times. Sometimes he goes like and do stuff that's more in, but he's like outside of a realm of music. But it's so interesting. Like he always has such interesting ideas about saxophone.
Yeah.
And he wrote this article against shredding, basically. And right. And again, I talk to Sam a lot, so you know, I know him. We're friendly. And I was like, you know what? That's a great idea. I'm gonna write. I told him that I'm gonna write.
Oh, brilliant.
You know, an article for shredding.
Yeah.
You know, that was kind of a response to him. So yeah, it was fun. It was fun writing.
I'm so glad I asked about that. That's super interesting. He was like the first guy I had like proper soprano sax, you know, just like improvising, sort of that experience. And also, like you say about him writing that case against shredding, just trying to like play musically and create something that not even like deal with harmony at this point. Just like, can you even play anything with someone else that's creative?
Yeah, you know, the thing to me that everybody, it's funny, but like you always hear people that don't know anything about saxophone say like, oh, this guy has the greatest technique. This guy has the greatest technique. And I'm like, you know, the people that have the most impressive technique to me are actually people like Sam Newsom or like a guy, Derek Brown. I don't know if you know Derek, that does the beatbox sax. But it's like they took the saxophone and they're doing something completely different. But if you want to do what they did, you have to spend like eternity just, you know, going in that route, right?
Yeah.
It's like all the people, like including people like me, you know, we just play lines. It's like we're all doing basically the same thing. Yeah, so that's how I feel, at least.
Yeah. No, I agree. For me, like good technique is like, can you improvise for like 30 minutes without repeating yourself? You know,
yeah, and be interesting.
Yes, and be interesting. I'm glad you added that in. That seems very important.
Yeah, but again, like everything, I think that it has to do a lot with academization. I don't know if it's a real world, probably not. But you know,
I know what you mean.
Music. You know what's funny to me about that? It's sometimes like me and the other Danny, we would talk and we would complain about Instagram and what it does to musicians and or like about all the music schools. And then we would hear like a Louis Armstrong interview or Lester Young interview that they complain about the same thing. Like not about Instagram, but like about Louis Armstrong has like an interview where he complains about people, instead of playing good music, trying to be hip and trying to play to the guy that like the musician that's sitting, you know, like leaning against the wall and can barely play themselves, instead of playing what's good and what he knows is good and what the audience likes. And or Lester Young, but he talks about Juilliard. But it's like, it's so funny to me that like it's this conversation started from day one.
Yeah.
We're not making it up.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. That's really cool. It was really interesting to think about as well. Danny, thank you so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast.
Thank you for having me. Sorry, I know I'm going rants that are sometimes unrelated, but it's just where my brain works, unfortunately.
No, it's all related. It's great to just get a piece of your mind and how you think and how you feel. It was wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, I talk like I play all the time.
No breaks. That. No breaks. There is no interval, people.
Yeah.
Fantastic. All right, nice one. I shall speak to you soon.
Perfect. Thank you, Rob.
Sick.
Have a good day.
Awesome. Bye. Bye.
Well done, Tara. That was Danny Markovich. Very interesting young gentleman. Plus, I want to do an album with Antonio Sanchez.
Don't we all?
That's, what a hell of a guest.
I know.
You think we could get him on one time?
I bet we can. I'm going to do that. Do you know what? Now's the perfect time to ask.
Because no one's got anything else to do.
Absolutely. Yes. And you know who else you have to ask? You need to get the second half of Stan Saltzman's podcast, because he only did half of one.
He did half of one. I could actually just walk over there. That's interesting.
Well, we're coming up to our year anniversary. Well, no, three, four?
Four. Yeah,
4 years.
4 years!
Crap. Yeah. Next month will be the 4 year anniversary show, so we thought we'd go back and interview Loz Garrett. But Dan, not just because it's Loz, but but I'm sure, I don't know if you remember 4 years ago, but Loz texted me this morning, which what made me think about doing him as a 4-year show.
Yeah.
And it, his text to me said, Rob, let me find it exactly how he wrote it. I just wanted to let you know, I hilariously am finally making my website.
4 years later. Very good.
So I thought we could celebrate Loz's website.
Fantastic.
That is well overdue. Is it live yet? Can we look at it?
He said he'll try and finish it by the time we release the show for the 4th year anniversary.
All right.
Look, we'll have a massive celebration.
How did you find that, Tara, your first Jazz podcast?
That was great fun.
You're being polite.
I'm not. It's just like talking with your mates.
Yeah.
And like, among us without the killing.
Yeah. We need to have a game now that Rob's resurrected.
Ooh, I love that.
Yes.
Let's do it.
Or are you going to go off grid again for another month?
No, I'm back. I'm back, baby.
You're back. Okay, good.
Yeah.
We're all very upset about Brexit, I think.
I've needed a couple of months to just, you know, the Biden inauguration was like the unfreezing from carbonite for my brain.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, something's happening.
It was very cool, but then we took over as the worst government in the Western world, and that made me a bit sad.
Yeah, well said. Very well said.
Sometimes. Right,
I'm going to go and walk around in the snow. Good work, everyone.
Do you still have snow?
Yeah, it's not melted at all.
Where do you live, Tara?
Jealous. Greenwich.
Greenwich, okay. A bit far east.
Where are you?
Sorry, I'm not far from Rob. Lots of snow here too.
Oh, lovely. Well, enjoy.
Yeah, you too.
Good work, everyone. See you soon.